Hello and welcome to the Martian Drive-In Podcast number 8. My name's Terry Frost, and this time we're looking at Nigel Neal's 1968 and very prophetic television play, The Year of the Sex Olympics. And we're going all the way back 82 years to 1930 to take a look at a very interesting little silly piece of comedy called Just Imagine, which is not without features of interest. So get settled to the spiel, and we'll be back in just a moment.
The Martian Drive-In Podcast is a four-weekly podcast of speculative fiction movie appreciation. Each 4 weeks, Terry and his guests will pick two movies and strip them to the bone. They can be new, old, or in between science fiction, fantasy, or horror. What they have in common is that they aren't the big blockbusters that everyone knows about. Martian Drive-In looks for the interesting films that might not be on your radar, but that might just be worth your attention and appreciation. Go to marsdrivein.blogspot.com. Feedback is always welcome via email at cultguru@gmail.com. That's K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U @gmail.com. Or you can leave a voicemail at area code 206-2033-299. Enjoy!
Okay, hope everybody's doing well. Here it's supposed to be late spring heading towards summer, but it's cloudy and rainy and not too warm, so I'm a little miffed about that. And also the fact that here in Melbourne we only got 50% of the total solar eclipse Northern Australia got. And so it kind of got a bit dim and then it got bright again and there wasn't that much to see from our point of view. But apart from that, things are going okay. I've made a third move. The man cave has moved from the small end room into the other one, which I was in last time we podcasted, and now into the larger of the three choices, one of which is going to be a bedroom. The other, the original podcasting cave, is now Sal's office up the end of the house, and she's done it up really nicely. But I'm in the larger of the three choices because in the second one, as you might have heard in previous podcasts, the acoustics really, really, really sucked. So I had to go with another option, which I've done. It's in a state of flux at the moment. There are piles of things everywhere. We haven't got the shelving in that we're going to get. And so I'm surrounded by the detritus of my life and pretty much every kind of music playing technology from about 1925 onwards. So having said that, we're going to get a podcast done. Now, what have I been watching? I did have a look at some movies, surprisingly enough, over the last 4 weeks since I did a Martian Drive-In podcast. I did The Princess Bride. I watched The Princess Bride for the ABC local radio and Darwin gig, and Ivor and I had a really good time with that one. Let me see. I saw The Raven, that movie with Edward Norton playing Edgar Allan Poe doing a detective thingy with the Baltimore police, And yes, not the best. If you're interested in Edgar Allan Poe, see it. If you're not, don't. That's all I can say. And we had a listener request too later on for Barbarella, so I'll rewatch Barbarella as well, and we talked about that on the radio, which was a fair bit of fun and just had a groovy time with that. As far as science fiction TV is concerned, what have I been catching up with? Fringe, keeping up with that. And not too much else. I've just kind of been vegging. And I've got this weird habit at the moment of watching compilations of science fiction and horror movie trailers that appear in various torrenting websites. So I've just been kind of vegging out and watching endless trailers and going, okay, I want to see that movie, and then trying to find a copy of it online the way you do. The upcoming big exciting thing here is that finally, weeks after everybody else gets it, Australia's getting Skyfall, the new James Bond film, next Wednesday, and it's Sunday as I record. And I'm there first night because I am going, well, actually Wednesday is Sal's birthday, but Thursday I'm going to see Skyfall because I'm talking about it on the radio on Friday night, which is all very exciting. We'd previously done Casino Royale and Quantum of Solace, and Ivor said, well, listen, are you going to see Skyfall? Would you like to talk about that as well? And I said, yes. So I'm looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to see how Javier Bardem goes as the main villain, and just embracing the grooviness of a new James Bond film. And as I said on the radio, a new James Bond film for people like me is like the Olympics is for sports freaks. You really look forward to it, you anticipate it, and you just suck it up. I suppose the other big news in the realm of science fiction cinema is the fact that George Lucas is going to let other people play in his sandpit and allow other people to make Star Wars movies. Now, I know that there are a lot of people squeeing about this one, and I fully appreciate that you had to be 7 years old when they came out to actually drink the Kool-Aid when it comes to Star Wars movies. But my interest factor is zero on this. I don't think it's a particularly rich world that they created. I think it's derivative. I think the characters are very two-dimensional. I just think that why the fuck bother? It seems to me purely, and this is no surprise when it comes to movies, a cash cow kind of thing to do. They're looking at ways of squeezing money out of the punters, of course, and they'll do it, and they'll kind of try to make it edgier and with more nuance and all that sort of stuff, because you can't really play things the way that George Lucas played them in 1977. And again in 2000, 2001, 2002. But yeah, I'm not really interested. I know a lot of people are. Good for you. Enjoy it. It's not my kind of bag. And I'm really more interested in smaller, riskier enterprises when it comes to my science fiction cinema viewing. You might have noticed too that I don't have a guest this time. I just haven't got my shit together to get a guest lined up, and it does take a little bit of work, and work is the problem. I'm very busy at work at the moment, and that kind of drains my energy a little bit. But having said that, I am looking at getting guests on board, and if people want to be a guest on Martian Drive-In Podcast, send me an email or a voicemail and I will rope you in, and we'll pick some movies and we'll have a lot of fun with it, because I do want to kind of get that going and make it definitely a part of this enterprise. But again, I apologize that I haven't done so yet. So I'm going to take a little bit of a break now, and when I get back, I'm going to look at the news from the planet Mars. Before I get on to talking about things science fiction, I do have to thank a listener. A nice lady called Grace sent a donation to the podcast via PayPal. So thank you very much for that. I should let you know, Grace, that I have wasted the money entirely by buying movie memorabilia with it. So thank you very much for that. Having said that, it does actually go towards the hosting for the podcast. But then, given that I pay it, any donations go to me. So I do appreciate that. I don't expect everybody to do it, but if you feel inclined, please do so. I'm sure I can find things to spend the money on, but if you don't, then the other good thing to do is, of course, give feedback. But thank you very much, Grace. I do appreciate that you listen. You do appreciate what's happening here. So good on you, and may good things happen to you. Now, on with the stuff. Nigel Neal. Everybody knows Nigel Neal. If you don't know Nigel Neal, you should. He was the guy who invented Bernard Quatermass. Quatermass in the Pit, Quatermass, Quatermass 2, Electric Boogaloo. He did the Stone Tapes, which is a very creepy little science ghost story, science-based ghost story, which is unusual. And he was, in 1967/1968, quite a pissed-off man. Reason for this is that the BBC sold the rights to Quatermass without giving him any money. Now, he invented it, he created it. BBC went and sold the rights to Hammer Films so they could make Quatermass in the Pit. They, of course, then had sold it previously for the movies that were made in the late 50s with Brian Dunleavy in them. But, yeah, he wasn't happy because of that. And rightly so, I think he should have got something for it. So he's pissed off with the BBC, which is odd because a BBC television program actually wanted him to do a television play for them in 1967, which of course became the year of the Sex Olympics. Now, the interesting thing about that is he said no because you guys ripped me off last time. So an ex gratia payment of 3,000 quid was thrown his way to sweeten the deal, and the production went on. So that's basically how it came about. Now, Nigel Neill's other bugbear, apart from the financial meanness of BBC warlords, and of course they're now in the shit for other reasons, was media itself. He'd been working in television. He had some concerns about the way television is going. About 11 years before this, he had done the BBC adaptation of 1984, the one with Peter Cushing in it. And he was very, very familiar with George Orwell. So what he was doing with this year of the Sex Olympics, essentially, is updating 1984 into the swinging 60s in some ways. Now, the big influences that 1984 had on this production was mostly, in a very interesting way, language reduction. Language reduction is it's a simplified language. To control the masses, you simplify their language so that they can't think certain concepts. Language allows you to think about certain things. Without the language, it's more difficult to express certain concepts. And the year of the Sex Olympics is spoken, everybody speaks in a reduced and simplified form of English with pretty much a transatlantic kind of accent. What here in Australia, back in the radio days before television came along, they used to call Woolloomooloo Yanks, where it's somebody who speaks with an English or Australian accent and then tries to fake an American accent to kind of sound very up to date. Now, this is now an old concept. We've learned how to embrace different regional accents a lot more. But in the middle part of the 20th century, this was a very big thing. And in year of the Sex Olympics, everybody talks in a transatlantic accent. Now, I'll just play you a little bit of a clip from the start of the series. Well, start of the show, sorry, because it is a one-off. It would never have been made a series. And just to give you a little bit of an idea of the banal television that people are having inflicted upon them in the world of the year of the Sex Olympics.
SportsSex presents tonight and every night.
Here we go again, butters and cottage. Comfy and cozy are you all? Tonight we've got lots of real sucking talent for you, so keep your eyes with us. Remember, all scores in this special new SportsSex series counts towards the Sex Olympics, the Jumbo World Event!
This is the year of the Sex Olympics, Sex Olympics here!
So keep looking, maybe tonight's winners make it to the Olympics. First round, men, and welcome to those King Star lovers, Cara Dindo and Stuart Tendley. Hello there, Stuart and Cara. Winners of the Kama Sutra Prize last year, picked up lots of points lately, and well in line for the Sex Olympics. Area 27 got top hopes with two.
Okay, I'll do the pricey of the plot of the year of the Sex Olympics from Wikipedia. Let me just see what I've got here. In the future, society is divided between low drives that equate with the labouring classes and high drives who control the government and the media. The low drives are controlled by a constant broadcast of pornography that the high drives are convinced will pacify them. Though one high drive, Nat Pender, Tony Vogel, believes that the media should be used to educate the low drives. After the accidental death of a protester during the Sex Olympics gets a massive audience response, the coordinator, Hugo Priest, played by Leonard Rossiter, decides to commission a new program. In the Live Life show, Nat Pender, his partner Deanie, and their daughter Ketan are stranded on a remote Scottish island while the low-drive audience watches. Mender's former colleague, Lazar Opie, played by Brian Cox. Yes, that Brian Cox. Realizing that something's got to happen, decides to spice up the show by introducing a psychopath. So I won't go any further than that because there's a hell of a punch at the end of this play. And even though I knew it was coming, I did find it really, really shocking and nasty and good in that sense, because I really think that Nigel Neal wasn't pulling any punches when he did this series. Now, there are some difficulties. It does, you have to pay close attention to this one. It's not something you can just kind of let wash over you while you're doing the knitting. You really need to kind of focus on it. Now, the reason first off for that is the simplified English spoken in the year of the Sex Olympics takes a little while for your ear to adjust to. That's why they just kind of did a setup in the first 20, 30 minutes of the show. It gives you time to tune your ear to the way people are talking in the thing. And that's a bold move to do. You risk losing audience by making the language being used different from modern language in a big way. For a start, you've got the transatlantic accents, you've got the concepts that people are talking about, you've got the really simple use of words. They've got about 125 word vocabulary in this, and that makes, of course, the writing a lot more difficult, but it also means that for us, you've really got to tune in and go, okay, that's what they're saying, but what's behind that? And there are some scenes that really typify the problem with language reduction, where the man, the woman, and the child are on the Scottish island and are trying to understand and communicate with each other in concepts beyond the limited concepts that their previous world allowed them to express. Feelings like love and desperation and hopelessness and sadness and grief, all of those kind of profound emotions, there weren't words for in their language, and they have trouble. They very much feel the emotions, but they have trouble communicating with each other and understanding that for the first time they're feeling these emotions. And even though some of the acting is a little weird at times, you do come to really kind of empathize with the characters on this island. They've volunteered to go there, and that's the other big thing about this play, is that it foreshadows Big Brother and all of those kind of reality TV shows. You've got to remember, reality TV came in late 90s, perhaps. This is 30 years before that. Nigel Neal's talking about doing this and talking about dumbed-down media as a way of controlling the masses and of basically making a very much more mean-spirited form of entertainment that had been seen before in the media landscape. I mean, this may have been a blueprint for the people at Endemol for doing Big Brother. If that's the case, then they really didn't get the message of Nigel Neal's play, which is that it creates a nasty world. In fact, there's a scene with Leonard Rossiter's character, Ugo Priest, where he explains how the world became the way that it is, that they were trying to stop population explosions and wars and all sorts of other things, and the risk of annihilating the human race was really great at the time. So they decided to really ramp up the media and create pornography as the mainstream of media, so that people would jerk off rather than reproduce. Of course, we know that this doesn't happen, and people often watch pornography together with a partner, and of course that will lead to sex, which will lead to potentially to population increases. But leaving aside that little bit of hindsight that we have about the nature of porn, and remembering in the 1960s it was mostly the province of guys in raincoats in little theatres around. So you've got the high drives who are making the television and running things, you've got the low drives who are the masses watching it, and you do see some. They have an audience monitor where they have a group of people who look very sad and depressed and, to be honest with you, working class, watching the shows, and they get immediate audience feedback from the way that these people are reacting to watching the programming. and that's used as part of their rating system, which allows them to tweak the product to the audience in a very direct way. And that's that again is something I found really interesting in the Year of the Sex Olympics too. The fact that the low drives aren't necessarily dumber than the high drives. What they are is depressed, and they're down, and they don't see any hope. And maybe they're more perceptive in some ways than the high drives. The high drives tend to be almost Aspie cases. They don't have an emotional attachment the way that we recognize it. But again, I'm looking at it from a 21st century viewpoint where we know a little bit more about autism spectrum and things like that. But it really is interesting to just watch some of those scenes and see the way things are being played and make your own interpretations to them, which everybody, of course, as an audience member, inevitably does in any kind of project. Now, I'll just talk about the set design and the costuming and things in this film. It's kind of very 60s high tech, which has got a lovely look to it. But it's not over the top. There are some things like the clothing that people wear is all kind of psychedelic paisley kind of clothing, bright colours with complicated patterns on them. The men tend to have long hair and a ponytail, and the women tend to wear mini skirts and have kind of over-exaggerated dolly bird makeup from the 1960s. So it's a kind of, if this goes on in fashion trends, this is what things will look like, which is an interesting choice. And, of course, you've got to give an audience, a 1968 audience in this case, a future that they can believe in. If you gave them our future, it would be too strange. If they had people dressing the way we do now, that would be an oddity for them. They'd have shorter hair, you know, bald guys would shave their heads, all that kind of stuff would be really weird to certain people looking from a 1968 viewpoint. But leaving that aside, I think they do a nice job with that too. And they've got a couple of twee little conceits in there too. There's a machine that plays auto chess. It plays both sides of the chess game because people are passive and they're not active. So the chess game is being done by a robot arm, and the people watch it rather than becoming participants and playing both sides of the chess game. That's just another little bit of background that Nigel Neal gives us in this series. Now, the villains of the film tend to be the people, of course, in any kind of dystopia, who embrace the status quo. And Brian Cox is really interesting in this. We know Brian Cox is the kind of portly older actor we know him as now, or maybe as far back as Manhunter, where he played the original Hannibal Lecter. But this is a kind of young and dynamic Brian Cox, acting larger than life. And, of course, the character he's playing has to be larger than life. And he's really got an incredible energy about him. You can tell this guy's going to go further than the other actors, except perhaps Linda Rossiter, who became a very well-known character actor. But the intensity that Brian Cox plays this at, and the kind of lack of sensitivity his character reflects, is done really well. And I like watching him in this film. Some of the other actors, I think in particular, the guy who plays Nat Pender, Tony Vogel, he tends to have a monobrow. For some reason, they've given him a monobrow, and he tends to look at things with an intensity all the time. Now, this kind of grows on you too, because what he's portraying really is bewilderment. He's part of the status quo for the first part of the film, but he really doesn't embrace it the way that the character Lazar Opie, played by Brian Cox, does. And when the character played by Martin Potter, who's a protester and who draws pictures of frightening faces, which they find terrifying. Everybody finds these pictures terrifying because they've grown up with media that's either pornography or in some ways lower common denominator, upbeat stuff. So suddenly they see pictures somebody drew of a scary face, and they find it profoundly frightening, the way that, say, showing somebody from an Amazon tribe that had never seen technology, an iPad, would be frightening and intriguing at the same time. It's outside their knowledge base. It's outside their world experience. And I found that good too. And the guy who keeps coming in with the scary pictures and trying to get them on the screen to scare the audience eventually dies as a part of one of his protests. He falls from a height in a television studio, and it gets a positive reaction from the audience, which is the trigger for doing this reality TV show, the Live Life show, and taking somebody, you know, taking three people to an island where there's a tiny little hut. There are some sheep and there are some gulls' eggs they can eat. And basically, they've got to fend for themselves on this island. It's Castaway, done on a cold and remote Scottish island. And that, of course, ramps up to an incredibly tragic ending from two points of view. From the point of view of the people on the island who are there for good, they're not coming back. They volunteered to be there. And from the audience reaction to that tragedy, and there's only one character in the thing, which is Ugo Priest, who knew people who knew the old world. He was old enough to know people who knew the old world. And suddenly understands the big flaw in this new world that they've created. This is a really powerful piece of television, particularly for 1968. It was so good, Mary Whitehouse protested against it. She got a hold of a script and made a big fuss trying to get the thing closed down. But the BBC hierarchy, to their great credit at the time, basically said no, and it went ahead. I found a clip that kind of demonstrates that difficulty in communicating language that the people in the show have. This one is a conversation between Tony Vogel's character and the artist who eventually dies, and his name's Ken Hodder, played by Martin Potter. So it's a conversation between Nat Mender and Ken Hodder and Deanie, the woman with whom they both had a relationship. And it's about the artwork that Ken Hodder creates. Basically, he's an artist, he draws things. And there's not even a word for drawing in the language. And this is a conversation between the three of them, just kind of trying to express his artistic need to do something besides set design and making pretty pictures in between the shows that keep the masses happy.
Nat Mander, you liked this Deanie. Anyways, you did then. So maybe we got some ideas the same.
Yeah, maybe.
You were in SportsX, the top show. You can help me.
Ken, he got to go.
He can help me. Tell me why to do this. Give me a reason. Make me want to do it.
No, it's hard to make it all clear right now.
You make it clear. Ever. You can.
Yeah, if you quiet down.
Well, then you tell me. No need to tell me when you start like that. I can guess it.
What do you mean?
Quiet down. You want to quiet down the whole world all the time. All them outside. We got to do our work for them. That it? Keep them like the rule says, cozy and comfy.
We got to, you know that.
And if not?
There'll be tension.
I want tension.
Come on, come and sit down.
Tension. You know what he's saying?
Gets him like that. Crazy.
Listen, you're not happy? You want to switch jobs?
I want to do what I want.
I tell him, try for Patton.
Good idea, that's artistic.
Patton?
Yeah, they do a lot, neat people.
Help computers make little moving shapes in between the shows to keep the audience calm. Know what I want to do? I want to make pictures.
Well, that's making pictures.
Pictures that stay. She knows.
He makes them.
When I get what to make them on, I want to show them to them out there, to the whole world. I want to make them see. I want them to hurt.
Nat, you look at them.
Her?
They do more than that.
Okay. Let me see them.
Now, for years and years, the Year of the Sex Olympics, I'd heard about, but I'd never seen it because it was considered a lost piece of BBC stuff. Like a lot of other things, BBC erased the tapes. There used to be a colour version that the BBC did, but that tape's been lost, and someone found a black and white version of it sometime in the 90s, and it's been released on DVD with a lot of commentary tracks and things like that. But for a long time, this was a missing piece of English science fiction history. And it's good that it's been retained. It really would have been a tragedy for this not to exist now, particularly when a lot of the themes that run through it are themes that we find in our day-to-day life, the dumbing down of language, the reality TV placating the masses, and sport, of course, being a part of that. Sport is just a great big pacifier for the masses, as far as I'm concerned. But if you haven't seen this, you really should. And the good thing is that all eight parts of it are on YouTube if you want to check it out. As I said, it's not a perfect print, and there is a little sound quality thing, as you might have got from the clips. I tried to tighten up the sound a little bit, but haven't been entirely successful with that. But this is important for a number of reasons. A, it talks to a lot of the things that are still being discussed today. You know, educating people, the dangers of having an uneducated populace. Of course, the American election has highlighted those in particular, where reality and inquiry and the scientific method are dismissed by a large number of people for simpler and kind of pat belief systems that don't evolve. So I really blew me away. The ending, as I said, the ending punched me in the gut when I saw it. And I think it's the right, perfect ending for this particular play. And also, I'll leave you with the idea that because of the way the Year of the Sex Olympics ends, what happens after that is a very important and horrible question. What happens after the Live Life show ends the way it does? So that's about it for that one. People hear the title Year of the Sex Olympics and they start thinking that it's basically a porno. And in a sense, it's almost the opposite of that. It's an analysis of media in the 20th century. So as I said, that's about it for that one. I'm going to take another break, and when I get back, I'm going to have a chat about Just Imagine. Okay, this is the news from the planet Mars, and it's not actually bad news. We've got some good news. There's a report on CNN today that the radiation levels on Mars are good for human life. They're less than people thought they were, and people will be able to live there without too much trouble, and at least from a radiation perspective. The big issue is getting there and getting back. That's where you really get the rats. But they're looking at that. But the news they got back from our friend the Curiosity rover is that things are a little nicer than they were, that we thought they were. So that's it. They're on the bad news side, and there is a little bit, maybe bad news, maybe not. Mars, the RAS rover Curiosity, can't find any methane on Mars, which is of concern to people who want some form of life on Mars, because methane being a byproduct of organic processes, farts being one of those organic processes that produces methane, they haven't found any examples of it yet. That doesn't mean there isn't some form of microbial life on Mars. It just means that where they are, there isn't any. So we'll wait and see what happens with that. But they keep finding new and groovy things with the Curiosity rover, which is always a lot of fun. And our knowledge of the next planet out just keeps getting more and more detailed. I mean, we had the broad picture from years ago, but now we're kind of drilling in on the detail, what the rocks look like, what the processes are that form the hills and the valleys, why do some of them look like there was liquid water there, all that kind of stuff. That's the kind of things they're starting to get some answers to, which is kind of groovy and always of interest. And if anybody NASA is listening and you want a movie podcaster to go with the first trip to Mars, I am there. Get the rocket, I am on it. I don't give a fuck. I'll risk the radiation, big deal. I just had my wrist radiated by a whole bunch of x-rays, so I'm acclimatized to radiation. but probably not quite as much as our friend Vince over at the B-Movie Cast, who works at a nuclear power station. So that's about it. Fairly good news from Mars. A, radiation ain't as bad as we thought it was. B, it doesn't smell like farts as far as we know. Okay, we're on to our second movie, which is from 1930, 3 years before the Volstead Act was cancelled. And it is Just Imagine. Now, you've got to remember, this is 2 years after Al Jolson was kind of ushered in sound movies. And it was probably among the first science fiction musical comedies of all time. Not that that's a particularly large field to play with. It stars Elle Brendel, Maureen O'Sullivan, John Garrick, and Marjorie Wright. Now, Elle Brendel is a weird phenomenon as an actor. He does a kind of comedy Swedish character, which is something you don't see much these days, except in The Muppets. And the L is short for Elmer. His full name was Elmer Goodfellow Brendel. And he was Irish and German. He wasn't actually Swedish at all. And he's born in 1890, died in 1964. And, you know, it's all that kind of yump and yimmy Swedish kind of thing. And, it doesn't play well to a 21st century audience in a weird way. But having said that, he does have a couple of little comedy bits which are quite interesting. And he plays it very broad, too. He's obviously, I came out of a stage background. He was a vaudevillian. And this is still, remember, 2 years after sound movies started. And he was playing as broad as a silent movie actor would. So it makes it a slightly weird thing. But it's all part of the history of cinema, really. It's all part of that transition from silent to sound. And the lovely thing about the film is that there's some very, very groovy special effects. There are some nice bits and pieces in it. Totally unrealistic. It's almost science fantasy in a way. But if you enjoy the history of science fiction cinema, it's worth checking out. It's one of those kind of putting the pin in the map kind of movies where you go, okay, I've seen that one. I understand where it came from. I understand the context of the film. And I understand the incredible number of dated jokes that are in it. Jokes about Prohibition didn't really play very well after 1933 when Prohibition ended. But I'll just give you a little bit of the narration from the start of the film where they tell you about the wonderful world of the year 1980 because it's set 50 years in the future from when the film was made. And in fact, the film was released 82 years ago tomorrow. It was on the 23rd, I think, of November. Actually, I was wrong. Later this week. It was the 23rd of November, 1930, it was released. But I'll just play this narration bit now to give you an idea of how wonderful the year 1980, so far in the future, will be.
If the last 50 years made such a change, just imagine the New York of 1980, when everyone has a number instead of a name, and the government tells you whom you should marry. Just imagine 1980.
Okay, so they got 1980 a little bit wrong. We didn't go to Mars in a space plane. We didn't have flying cars. And we don't eat pills instead of food, which is one of the big jokes. And we don't drink alcohol via pills. And Prohibition is not still around. So basically, they got a couple of minor details on 1980 wrong, but you got to forgive them that they didn't have any way of knowing. But I'll give you a little bit of the news from the real 1980 just to give you an idea of what happened. Mount St. Helens erupted in 1980, Pac-Man was released, Rubik's Cubes became popular, and John Lennon was assassinated. So basically, none of that was in this movie. So they got those bits wrong. But the thing is that they cut directly from that narration to the future of New York in 1980. And it's very, very similar to the future-looking thing in Metropolis, the Fritz Lang Metropolis from 1926, except it's New York City. And they've got that kind of Gernsback continuum Art Deco-y looking future, which is kind of groovy, that retro future look is... really an interesting little bits and pieces. And they do have some kind of funny in-jokes if you know the historical context of this thing. For instance, all the flying cars have Jewish names because Henry Ford, the car manufacturer, was very anti-Semitic. So the joke is they kicked Henry Ford in the guts by making all the cars with names like Tannenbaum and things like that. So there's that joke. There's the joke of having bootleg liquor, but the liquor's in pill form. And people are kind of slyly giving each other pills instead of slyly giving each other hip flasks. You've got that. You've got the weird conceit of the government being able to grant licenses for marriages based on if two guys want to marry one woman and she's kind of sort of agreed to marry one of them. The judge decides which one's got the best achievements in life and she gets to marry that one. And if you saw that in a modern movie, you've got a future where basically the government controls who gets married to whom. They're going to have somebody smash and overthrow the system. You're going to overturn that. The draconian and dystopian government apparatus is going to be challenged and overrun. Doesn't happen in this one. What the guy does instead, which I find quite interesting, is he's looking for some way to achieve a greater contribution to society than his rival. And to do that, he meets up with a really weird scientist guy played by Misha Auer, who just happens to be going in a space plane to Mars. And of course, that being a very significant achievement, he then gets the judge, he'll then be able to get the judge to overturn the decree saying that the other guy, who, because his father's rich and he runs a newspaper, gets to marry Maureen O'Sullivan. So that's basically a bit of a different thing and a different viewpoint on the way people at that stage, to a certain extent, saw the rule of law, which I found kind of a little bit different and a little bit interesting. These days you just go, fuck you, I'm marrying her anyway. Doesn't work like that in this film. And the character of Single O, played by Earl Brendel, is kind of our viewpoint character in a weird, fucked up, and almost intellectually disabled way. He's the guy from the 1930s world in the future, of course. And I'm not even particularly sure whether he's a necessary part of it. Everybody else is, I mean, you've got the ingenue who leads Maureen O'Sullivan and John Garrick singing in each other's faces and all that kind of thing. You've got Earl Brendel popping in and out now and then and smuggling himself on a space plane to Mars. And, it's just an odd little bits and pieces kind of picture in some way. Maybe because we see much smoother product now where there have been any number of rewrites and a number of different people sticking their fingers into the screenplay of a movie that we have a different expectation now. But in this one, it really is he's an odd character and, of course, very broadly comedic in an old vaudevillian sense. And, of course, that makes him, of course, historically a little bit interesting. But the film kind of has the two parts, one of which is the romance between the ingenue leads on Earth and then they go to Mars. And then you get some really weird stuff happening on the planet Mars. It's very much like the 1924 Soviet movie Elita, if you can take a look at some stills from that. It's got that kind of spiky costumes on everybody and a little bit Flash Gordon-y, though this predates the Flash Gordon movies. And the other thing I should mention, too, while I remember it, is that the machines that resurrect Single O from 1930 to 1980 are the same machines by Kenneth Strickfaden that were used a year later in Frankenstein. So you've got all those spark gap generators and throbbing lights and tubes of glowing stuff and all that kind of thing that were used in Frankenstein. So this was actually the first time that machinery was used in a film. So you'll see it towards the start of this. And it is quite impressive. I don't even know how they did the thing with the two rows of hooped lights going through each other and all that sort of thing. But it is a very groovy effect. And it shows that they did pay a little bit of attention to this film. And the set designs are interesting. there's a scene where there's a video camera, there's a video phone on the wall, and they have a little bit where the girl doesn't realize that the a call's been made and she's in her lingerie. And of course, this is one of those first examples of that kind of thing outside of a porno movie that I can recall. Now, you've got to remember that was one of the objections that Wowzers gave to telephones originally, that people would be able to essentially say salacious and loving things to each other over long distances. And there actually was a lot of worry about the immorality of the telephone. So video phones, of course, have come, and if you want to use that word, and now everybody's taking selfies, and it's kind of taken for granted that occasionally things do get out of hand in that area, which kind of goes to show you that there's nothing really new in the universe. It's just kind of an evolution of technologies to do various bits and pieces. Originally it was love letters, and now we've got to people sending selfies to each other. So basically, not too much really else to say about Just Imagine. It's got a couple of cute little songs in there, and they've got a really weird thing that when the people are singing, they seem to be looking slightly to the left of the camera rather than into the camera to sing the songs. That, again, is part of film being a fairly new medium. But just to tie it up, it was an interesting little piece of science fiction history. The sets are great. The technologies, including the flying cars, are very groovy looking. In fact, the space plane going to Mars was used in films for the next 20, 30 years. You'll see it in Zombies of the Stratosphere, and I think Flash Gordon used it as well. So it's a prop that got some good service in Hollywood. L. Brendel, you can either take or leave him. The conceit of having pills for food, which dates back, I think, to Hugo Gernsback back in the magazines he was publishing at the time. They have a vending machine for babies. So, and of course, the single O character says that the old-fashioned ways are often the best. And other little bits and pieces like that, where they're being playful with the idea of technological progress and really not seeing it in a threatening way, but seeing it as an amusing thing and seeing the fact that people get affected by changes in technology and kind of learn to accept them very much as part of their world. So in that case, it's definitely on the side of rationality and reason as far as technology is concerned. It didn't get the details right. There's no CNN being launched in this film, for instance, and Ted Turner took over CNN in 1980. But it's cute, and it's dated, and it's silly, and it's what the fuck at times, but it's a part of our science fiction cinema history, and therefore it's to be enjoyed and seen in the context of its own time. And I do like the fact that they still had prohibition in 1980 in the film. I think that they were taking the piss out of that big time. And, oh, yeah, that's the other thing I meant to mention about this film. Sorry. They go to Mars, and everybody on Mars has a double. They've got a good double and a bad double. And there's a big, buffy-looking guy in a fuzzy headdress and a breastplate and a kind of furry kilt kind of thing who takes a shine to Single O. He's a gay character. And Single O makes the comment that she's not the Queen of Mars, he is. So this is pre-code stuff. And, you know, he's kind of flirts a little bit with the guy, and there's some interesting little bits and pieces with that, which kind of accept that this guy is gay, which is really a surprising and interesting thing. But, of course, the evil twin version of the character on Mars is nasty and brutish and very butch. So, again, you find these little moments that kind of foreshadow our attitudes to things in some films. It's a bit like in a very bad Al Jolson film called Wunderbar, where he goes, "Boys will be boys," when a couple of guys go dancing past in a ballroom. And again, there's a kind of acceptance almost that there is a diversity of sexuality in the world. And I really like that. It's a start of something that we've now evolved as a society, and hopefully will continue to evolve, of accepting that there's a continuum of human desire that really should be treated as a part of who we are. So that's it. Just imagine 1930, a little piece of science fiction cinema history that I found a bit of fun and I thought I'd share with you. Another break, and then I will be back with feedback. And we do have feedback this time, and I'm very, very happy that we do. Just a little bit from the Mike Curb and Charles Fox soundtrack for Barbarella, just to get you in the mood for this feedback. I'll play Vince's one first. I got a bit of feedback from Vince Rotolo over at the B Movie Cast.
Hey Terry, this is Vince with some feedback for the Martian Drive-In Podcast. Just real quick, I'm on long work hours. I'm working 6 12-hour days. I'm working night shift. It's about 1 a.m. right now. Haven't been able to do my own podcast because we're just too tied up with work and everything, but been able to listen to some, and yours is one of the top ones on the list. And just wanted to say how much we've been enjoying it. Some of the stuff you covered this past week was some stuff that I've actually got to watch. UFO is one of my favorite TV shows. I got the whole set. Watch it a good bit. I think we covered that on episode 32. Also, Creation of the Humanoids was mentioned. I think we did that on episode 59. Really enjoyed that. It's one of my favorite flicks. Talked about Existence, a Cronenberg film. They're always nice and creepy. I like that one. And Doomwatch I'd like to track down. I haven't been able to see that, so that sounds real interesting. Also, real quick, we got to see Frankenstein and The Bride of Frankenstein, double feature on the big screen, thanks to Turner Classic Movies, so that was really a good experience. And just like I said, I've been enjoying the cast and keeping us entertained here at work. And also, just a quick note on Paleo Cinema, loved the episode with you and Zom talking about Burt Lancaster. That was cool. Hope you do some other ones like that, maybe Steve McQueen, Lee Marvin, those guys. Bunch of stuff to do, but like I say, we are still out here listening, so really enjoying the show, and that's about it. Thanks, Terry. Bye.
Thanks for the groovy soundtrack music in the background there too, Vince. Well, listen, take care of yourself, mate. I know you're working hideously long hours and odd shifts at the moment, and it's got to be hard just on you and Mary alone, let alone getting your podcast out. And I realise that you are in a little bit of a hiatus with that at the moment, but I'll be back listening again, and always do. And you and your ensemble do a fantastic job there with classic and creepy and sometimes not very good science fiction and horror movies. So you're doing very good stuff there, and you've built such a beautiful, loyal fan base as well, which I really appreciate being a part of. So thanks for that, mate, and take care of yourself, particularly with the weird weather you guys are having over there at the moment. Now, the other thing I should mention too is that there is the Martian Drive-In Yahoo group. Haven't been able to get to that very much myself lately, but feel free to dip your fingers in, ask questions, throw stuff out there as well. The link's on the webpage, marsdrivein.blogspot.com. And but I will be getting more onto that as things settle down with my workload as well, and moving around these rooms. We're playing musical chairs at the moment, as I said earlier in the podcast. But by the time I do the next Martian Drive-In, I should have the expanded man cave all in a groovy state. And I'll post a few pictures as well if people like. But on to the next piece of feedback. And again, thanks, Vince. This one is from Nick Sauer, who was really good enough to start the Yahoo group, and he does mention it a little later in his voicemail. But thanks again for that, Nick. And again, I'm going to try to get on it just a little bit more than I have been lately.
Hey, this is Nick Sauer calling in from New Jersey. I just wanted to talk about the latest Martian Drive-In podcast with talked about David Cronenberg's existence, and a little more interest to me was the discussion of UFO and Doomwatch. I was really, really happy to see you're just going to be discussing genre TV shows as well as movies on Martian Drive-In podcast. I think it's great. As far as the first two shows, you cover great, great choices. Doomwatch, boy, I really wish that were available readily on DVD. It would be awesome. Unfortunately, I've never seen it, but I've just been dying since I was a kid and first read about it to check it out. As far as UFO goes, though, I own that, and I totally agree with you, Terry. It's an awesome, awesome TV show. It's fun as hell to watch. Classic case of the whole being greater than the sum of its parts. It's my favorite of Gerry Anderson's live-action series as well. Like you said, it's just so easy to put in a DVD and end up watching one episode and find out you end up watching like three or four when you're done. So I'm really hoping you continue with this and do more genre shows as well. One I would like to recommend, actually, I'm two-thirds of the way through it myself right now, is a show called Charlie Jade. It's a really unusual show. It was a Canadian and South African co-production that no one really seems to know a whole lot about, but it's probably definitely worth checking out. At least so far, I've been quite impressed with it. One thing I wanted to comment on was Prometheus. So one thing I don't agree with you on in the thing was Prometheus. While the movie is far from perfect, I think there was some interesting ideas in there, at least enough for me and some of my work colleagues to have a fairly decent discussion about it. But, you know, to each his own, I guess. The last thing I'd like to do is remind people to, you know, sign up for the Yahoo group that I set up for the Martian Drive-In podcast. The link is right there on the Martian Drive-In podcast website. You know, and you know, let's get as many members on there as we can, and you know, just feel free to discuss stuff. What's that line by Tom Lehrer? It's kind of like a sewer. What you get out of it depends on what you put into it. So, you know, can talk about, you know, the movies that Terry's talked about and his guests talk about, and or talk about maybe movies you think he should cover and stuff. So, anyway, it'd be nice to get people in the group and talk about things. And in any case, I'm absolutely loving the podcast. I'm really looking forward to the next one, and keep up the excellent work, and I'll talk to you all later. Bye.
Yeah, I definitely do want to make genre television a part of Martian Drive-In podcast. Maybe not as much as the movies, but I will throw things in as they kind of pop up in my head. And I'm just looking at the shelf at the moment with all of the DVDs for TV series in it. And there's a considerable number of them. And yeah, I've got a copy of Charlie Jade. I think I watched a couple of episodes but got distracted by reality. I'll probably go back to it because no use having the whole series unless... you watch it, of course, but there are a number of other ones I'm looking here going, okay, yeah, I want to talk about that, I want to talk about that, I want to talk about that. So it'll definitely be an ongoing part of the podcast, and yeah, it does seem to get a good reaction, so I'm pleased to make it that. Let's see, we're going to have to disagree on Prometheus. I think that visually Ridley Scott's interesting as far as being a science fiction filmmaker is concerned. But he's kind of rehashing a lot of old tropes, and I find that less attractive. But, I mean, he's very popular, and you can always kind of use that as a basis. But for me, I've got other fish to fry, and I'd fully accept that that's a divergent viewpoint and not shared by everybody. Yeah, one of the things I've got at the moment is I've got the radio going every week, so I've got to watch a movie and do that. And I've also got the podcast to consider as well. So between that and the workload, things have been a bit flat out, but I'm going to continue because this is what I do as a passion, and one has to have passions in one's life, of course. So that's about it for the feedback, and thank you to everybody who popped in and had a chat. Next time around, I have no idea what I'm going to be doing next. I'm going to try to get rope in a guest. And again, if you want to be a guest, please drop me a line. Happy to have people there. You've got to be able to talk on knowledgeably about things, and I realize that some people are happy to be listeners and don't think they can do this stuff, but to be honest with you, it's a conversation when you've got two people there and it just flows, and it's pretty easy to do once you get into it. So that's, as I said, that's about it. We're heading into the December season. Sal's birthday is on the 21st, so if you want to send her congratulations and all that kind of stuff, definitely do so. Friend her up on Facebook, bombard her with the love. I'm taking her out to dinner at an American style diner in Paran, in fact, so that should be a bit of fun for us. As I said, Thursday I've got Skyfall. Friday I'm talking about Skyfall on the radio, and then Saturday I'm going to see it again with a group of friends. So basically my next week is taken up with Sal's birthday and Daniel Craig. So it should be a groovy time, and I'm really looking forward to seeing the film, and of course a lot of other films that are coming up. Probably I might also throw in next time around, if I remember to do it, just a little bit of a rant about what makes a good science fiction movie and what makes a bad science fiction movie and what makes a bad science fiction movie that's so bad you can't enjoy it. But anyway, look after yourselves, watch the skies, and I will be back in 4 weeks with another Martian Driving podcast, and in 2 weeks with yet another Paleo Cinema podcast. So take care, and it'll be the Newton Mass episode next time around, because I don't celebrate Christmas. I celebrate the birthday of Isaac Newton and give gifts of knowledge. So catch you later, people.